So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that for me, being old-fashioned on purpose means more than just gardening or preserving food. Honestly, it's really become a way for me and my family to look at the world and question all the systems, not just the most obvious ones. And also, over the years, you've really seen me dig into my curiosity around the phenomenon of social media and the echo chambers it creates. So, of course, polarization is nothing new, but it's certainly been exacerbated by social media. We're seeing that now, especially during an election year. And it's prompted me once again to go back to the question I ask about everything. And that's how we can return to what is healthy and beneficial and normal, if we can use that word, for us as humans. So today we get to dive into that very question with one of my favorite online thinkers and creators, Will Ruch. I have been listening to his podcast, Cylinder Radio, and following him on social media for a while. I'm really excited for this conversation because he is incredible at bringing nuance and critical thinking into all sorts of sticky topics. And he's also an educator and a mentor who recently founded a platform to inspire critical thinking in high schoolers. And so whether you're a homeschool parent or you're just curious how we can build bridges in an era that's telling us to stay in our silos, you're going to love this episode. So welcome, Will.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jill. This is really cool. It's nice to, I always felt like a weirdo kind of like by pulling apart all the nuance and kind of, you know, getting out from what everyone else is doing. So, it's nice to be appreciated. And I see what you're doing. You're kind of a weirdo in your space too, you know, as far as like what society would say, society would call you a weirdo, right? For doing what I think has been the norm for most of human existence, but yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Weirdos unite. Those are my people.
So, let's go.
Yeah. Love it. For anyone who's not familiar with you already, I know some of them are, but could you just give us a little bit of your background and how you got to this point in your career, in your life? Because I think it's a really fascinating trajectory.
Yeah, thanks. So graduated college. I was a secondary education social studies major. So I went right into teaching. Grew up in a very traditional, you know, East Coast. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, East Coast kind of life. We had, you know, the picket fence and the small house, and we walked to school, and it was like all this stuff. It was very siloed. You know, all I kind of knew was my area, but I was just driven to seek more. So I graduated college and moved out to California. And, you know, that like cliche going out in the convertible with a buddy of mine, and we found a spot at the beach and did that whole thing. And I love teaching from jump. You know, I just found my calling in helping young people kind of make sense of the world. You know, I teach social studies, so it's history, government, economics, things along those lines. But I'm not like a history buff. I don't dress up as a Confederate soldier on the weekends. It's not really my thing. It's more about just figuring out the best way to do life. And I think that history is learning from the past successes and failures of others. You know, you touch the stove, you burn your hand, and then you tell everyone, don't touch that stove. That's, you know, learning from history. And then I met my wife, and she is from she's the opposite of me in every way, personality wise, but also she's an immigrant from the Philippines, came here. She was, you know, they were very impoverished when they first came here, and she just opened my eyes up to all these different like perspectives. There's more than one way to, you know, raise kids, but also like load the dishwasher. You know, I mean, it's literally like everything. So that opened me up to the idea of viewpoint diversity. And when I heard people talking about viewpoint diversity and how that's a way to understand the world, I just leaned into that. I was like, oh, that makes sense to me. And then I started Cylinder Radio, which is a viewpoint diversity podcast. I went on social media to just connect with people, to learn from people. You know, it's a social network, and it's interesting how people just consume instead of produce, or instead of connecting with people. They cast judgments instead of like, I would love to know what someone who thinks along these lines or someone from this background thinks. Like, you can actually connect with people. I've connected with so many interesting people on social media, and it's rare that it gets used that way. So I just brought all of those kind of lessons into my classroom to get my students to think like there might be other ways of doing, you know, things right or correctly that you just didn't have on your radar. And I think that's at the core of what learning is all about. You know, I love fostering curiosity. Just curiosity, just get curious about everything. And I think that that's the pathway to true like understanding of topics, is just to lean into your natural curiosity. And unfortunately, curiosity is kind of purged in the school system in a lot of ways. You know, I often say that the school system exchanges curiosity for compliance. If you think of like, Joe, like think of like what makes a good student. It's someone who does what they're told. They show up on time. They regurgitate the information that's given to them. They leave when the teacher tells them to leave. That's what makes a good student. You just do what you're told over and over and over again. But then what that does is it builds a whole society of kind of like automatons come the appeal to authority, whatever the authority tells me to do, I'll do. And we saw that, you know, during COVID, we see that with a lot of different things where people just do what the on highs tell them to do. And I think that that starts in the school system. So I've been trying to buck that my whole career. And then now with Patterdox, it's a way to take what I've been doing successfully in the classroom and get it out to as many people as possible, including the homeschool community, which I was not super familiar with. But the more I get into it, the more I'm like, oh, this is awesome. Like there's so many options about how to equip your children that school just leaves out.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the pieces of your story that I was most fascinated by, because I've seen a lot of discussion about critical thinking in homeschool circles, but your background in the public school system is fascinating because you just don't see that. And that's not to cast too broad of a sweeping statement over, because there are a lot of teachers who I know are curious, but you don't see it as much. And so I think your ability to hold on to that piece and be in that system for as long as you were is impressive.
Yeah. And I taught public, I taught charter, I taught private. I've kind of been all around, just so I you're very diverse students who were homeless and students who were, you know, the kids of hedge fund billionaires. I think there are great teachers. I think there are teachers. If you ask any teacher in the country, you know, do you support critical thinking? They would say yes. But there are those third rail topics, those topics that you are emotionally triggering maybe. And those is though when you dive into those topics, then the critical thinking goes right out the window. So I think it needs to be universally applied to all areas, not just the ones that are comfortable to talk about, you know?
Exactly. Yes. And I would just, you know, you're speaking to saying, you know, you were in a variety of students from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. I think that does change you a lot. I try to really encourage people. There's such a desire. People ask me, well, how do I find like-minded people, you know, like-minded in homeschooling or homesteading? And I'm like, you don't always want to find like-minded people. You're going to be stretching and you're going to be growing yourself. You're going to be developing that curiosity by being with such that wide variety. And it's so crucial, I think, to be able to develop that curiosity and that diversity. So I like that you said that.
Yeah. During COVID, we were teaching, you know, teachers across the country were teaching remotely on Zoom. And I was kind of commiserating with a teacher that I was friends with. She taught at an all-Black school in Atlanta. And then I was at the time at a Jewish private school in like Beverly Hills. And we were both just like, oh man, this really stinks. And I was like, you know what we should do? Let's blend our classrooms. So one of the days in COVID, we both jumped in. We blended our Zoom rooms, and then we gave the kids a prompt because we were both doing US history, and we broke them off into breakout rooms. So there were like three of my students and three of her students in all these different rooms. And then she and I were just kind of sitting back. And then every once in a while, we'd like dip our, you know, go in and like, just like, see what was going on, and then come out and talk about it. It was so cool because when it was done, she was like, you know, my kids loved it. I was like, my kids loved it. She's like, my kids they revealed to me that they've never had a conversation, not just with a Jewish person before, but with a white person before on equal footing. They never just had like a conversation among teenagers with someone from a very different background. My kids said the same thing. And it was like, wow, that's available to us. There's a lot of negatives to technology, but that is amazing. And that's something that I have also with why, you know, I love teaching in person, but there's a benefit to teaching remotely where you can connect with people who are very different and you can just learn. It was so cool because teenagers are teenagers, you know, like I said, I taught in like poor areas, I've taught in rich areas, you know, everyone's worried when they get a pimple before the prom, you know, like there's a lot of things that they have in common. And I think finding those shared values and that common ground is so important because in society right now, in America, we're all at each other's, you know, throats for everything. You know, they're the bad guys and they're the bad guys and people who vote for that person are dumb or whatever it is. And it's like, you have a lot more in common than you think. So look for that kind of stuff. But you also probably have a lot of blind spots when you're stuck in your echo chambers or around people that think like you. So exposing to people that you respect of like, what am I missing here? You know, like, why do you think so differently than me? And not just say it as a rhetorical, how could you possibly vote for that person? But actually as a sincere question, like, what am I missing here? I think that person's repugnant, or I think that person is dumb or ignorant or dangerous. What am I missing here? And you say that with sincerity, you'll get some answers and you might not change your mind. But I think we're not always just trying to find, we're not trying to agree. We're trying to disagree better. And I think that like seeking understanding, even if you don't agree, is extremely beneficial. I think it's what's lacking, one of the things lacking in society right now.
I agree, especially as we see on both sides. And it's funny because sometimes we'll talk to certain people and, you know, they're like, well, I have to do this and I have to say this because the other side's trying to, you know, hurt America. And I'm like, do you realize, but they think the same thing about you. Like, we're
ironic,
we're all
right?
So ironic. Yeah, I'm like, they think they're also saving America, but it's just those conversations and just seeing them eye to eye, human to human. It does so much. It does so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it's so important. And that's something that I'm fostering, you know, as much as I possibly can, whether it's on my social media with Paradox, you know, with like the consulting that I do, is just there's stuff that you're missing here. Are you curious about what that is? Because when you start to reveal the things that you're missing, you know, your blind spots, you're just going to get a better understanding of the world. And once you understand the world better, you're going to be more able to become successful because you're going to understand topics better. And just in general, I think it's just a good strategy for success.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. I'm just curious because it seems like there's fewer people who are willing to sit in the gray or be okay with the nuance or ask the questions. And I'm always curious, how do we go from, or how does someone go from being maybe more dogmatic and make that shift into someone who can sit with two ideas at the same time or ask the questions or look someone in the eye? And I'm curious, did you go through that transition personally? Were you more dogmatic, or I know you said you were more siloed in kind of a traditional childhood, but were you more dogmatic or black and white at one point in your life, or have you always been more open?
I think it's both. I mean, I had like a clear view of like this side is good and that side is bad, or anyone who supports that is bad. But I was also willing to hear them out. I think I was always kind of willing to hear them out, but I always had it with like some cynicism of just like, all right, they're wrong, but I'll still listen to them. But what you need to do is you need to have some intellectual humility. I think that once I had enough experiences where someone goes, well, here's what you're missing, Will, and they would break it down for me, someone from a different background or you know, some sort of area of expertise that I was very ignorant in. And I would go, oh my gosh, I never thought about that. You know, like, payday loan places, you know, where you go in and you get a, you know, you can get a loan, like a small loan. And then you, you know, when you get your paycheck, you give them, and it's like a high interest rate. And I used to think those were like predatory loan places. I was like, this is just wrong. It's wrong. It's feeding on the impoverished in like the hood or whatever. And I talked to a guy who grew up in Compton, and he was talking about how, you know, he was able to pay rent because of those places several times. He was able to get his, you know, his kids' food from those places several times. That those were the opportunities that like a traditional bank would not offer him. So I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, like those places, yeah, they can be bad, but they also can be good. And that's kind of like everything, Jill. It's like, you know,
yes,
guns
yes.
can be bad, can be good. Like yeah. there's so much wealth can be bad, can be good. All this stuff, it's all about how you use it. And once I had that a couple of times, then it just really, you know, like, crushed my ego when it comes to like, I have this all figured out. You only take a couple of those in different areas. And then you go, all right, I have a lot to learn about everything. And then I just changed the journey. That's a fun journey to figure out the world and to like learn more. Like that is fun. I think.
I agree. Same. Yep. And when the unraveling started for me it was the same thing. One area I'm like, wait, it's not what I thought. What else isn't what I thought? And it's, maybe the first few steps are unnerving, but then, like you said, it's fun. Then you're like, what did I not realize? It's like the whole world kind of opens up. So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Do you know what I think it is? I think what it was I shifted my ego from being the one with the right answers. And a lot of people are like, their ego is like, I'm correct. I'm right. I'm smart. And I shifted it from that to getting to the right answers. My identity is not the guy that has the answers at all. Like, I've never been like the sage on the stage, you know, to teach my students. It's more of, this is my process to get to the right answers. And I'm always wanting to get to the right answers, to get to the deeper truth. And when you have that kind of like growth mindset perspective, then you're never going to achieve it, but you're always going to be on that journey. So when someone says, I know you're wrong and I can prove it, I don't get protective. So many people protect their ideas. Like, if you look in this box, you're going to be proven wrong. They go, well, I'm not looking in that box. That seems so silly to me. Yeah. Instead, let me see the box. I don't want to walk around with bad information. I don't want to walk around, you know, with wrong answers. So give me the right answers. Will, you're wrong. It's like, thank you. Yes. Give me a hug. Like, thank you. Because now I can exchange the idea I had. Yeah. That one's gone. And this new input is going. It's like updating my software. And if I'm focused on constantly updating my software, then I'm just going to get better and better and better. And my ego is connected with getting to the right answers, not having them. So I'm not going to protect them. That's why I like conversation much more than debate. Debate's like, I'm right and I'm going to prove that you're wrong. But what if they make a good point? Then you're just going to ignore that good point? So I like conversation.
We see that in debate so much. I'm like, that was a good point, but you can't hear it because you are your mind is already made up. And it's like, what is the point of this whole thing? Like, minds are rarely changed. They're rarely changed.
What is the point? You know, I think that you have to start that. It's like I'm a first principles thinker. Like, what is the point of engaging with people that are different than you? Is it to prove them wrong, or is it to just get to the right answers? Because I think, you know, if like the political world, like Democrats and Republicans both believe they have the right answers, but if they're so dug into their way, you know, it's like, what is the core principle behind the policies that you support? You know, you can take a controversial issue like affirmative action. Okay. And you would say, like, what's the core principle behind you supporting affirmative action? It'd be like, well, giving, you know, a helping hand to people who've been the victims of systemic oppression, you know, throughout the past or something. And then you get information about how it's not doing that. Then you should go, all right, well, my core principles are still the same, but my policy changes are different. And that's why I think we're seeing a little bit in the political world is people who say, like, you know, like someone like Bill Maher is like, I haven't changed. It's like everything else has changed. And I think that that's because his core principles are kind of the same that they've always been. It's just the policies have shifted. So don't marry yourself to your policies, marry yourself to your core principles. And then the policies can change because your core values stay the same. I think those are important to maintain. You know, you develop those for a reason, and then just be willing to go, all right, well, then I'll shift my perspective. I'll shift my political party. I'll shift whatever it is because I want to maintain my core values.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that where we get into trouble and where we are right now is we go from principles into ideology and we just get stuck. And it reminds me, I was raised in a high control religion. Some people call it a cult. So I'm very familiar with that fundamentalist fervor. And what I see in both sides of the political aisle right now is we are holding on to those principles, be damned. It's all about like my religion and my ideology. And I'm like, whoa, 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 guys, we've missed it. We've just missed it. So yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of
intellectual. Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I think a lot of ideologies have become religion for people. You know, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, a lot of like the, for lack of a better term, like the woke stuff, which is a pejorative term, but I think you just know what we're talking about.
Yes.
Critical social justice. It, you know, it did come out of the new atheist movement in a lot of ways. Right. I had, you know, Colin Wright on my podcast who broke that down and stuff. I'm a Christian, like we're a Christian household, but like, I don't want my kids just to follow this because I tell them to. I tell them to question it all the time. I actually came to faith later in life through watching debates and conversations and reading atheist books and reading, you know, agnostic books and spiritual books and then reading, you know, apologetics books and just kind of like weighing it all out. And that's what I want for my kids. I don't want them to just do what I said blindly. Like, you better go and you gotta pray this way. Right. I want them to like go on their own journey. I think it's going to be longer lasting if you arrive there on your own feet, you know, your own merit. So, I think that's the problem with ideologies. It just gives you like a simple answer. I think religions do too. It just gives you a simple answer.
Yeah.
And if you're not willing to challenge those answers and challenge those ideas, then it's just being dogmatic. And I'm against the dogmatism of a lot of religions and a lot of ideologies.
Yes,
for sure.
Same. Yep. And I've seen where it leads, and it's not good. It's not good for anything for us as individuals or society. So yep, absolutely.
Yeah, that's happened in religious circles. Probably maybe the way you grew up. It's like, you can't ask that question.
No, we couldn't ask questions. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about it now. Now I ask all the questions, because once the dam broke, I'm like, now I'm asking everything. I'm going to question everything. And it was a heck of a journey. But yeah, like, I think maybe I'm more sensitive to it now in just the broader societal realm, just because I've been so entrenched in it for a period of my life. So I'm like, no, don't go there, guys. Stop. It's not as good as you think. We need to ask better questions. We need to stay curious. But
so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk more in a minute about how we can impart these skills to our children, whether they're our own children or we're in education or something. But kind of before that, I want to pull back a little bit. I'm just curious, especially just with how you think and your background in social studies, what's the historical perspective here? Because everything goes in cycles. And to your knowledge and to your studies and your research, have we ever been this polarized as a nation before? Is this a new thing? Is this a social media, phenomenon? Or is this just a cycle of humanity, do you think?
I think that we've been in this situation. I mean, you can go back to Hamilton and Jefferson, you know, the anti-federalists and the federalists. You can go back, you know, the Democratic Republicans and the federalists. You know, we've always been divided, this idea of like, who should rule? Should it be the elite or should it be the commoners? You know, which, and that's kind of gotten screwed up with the modern political system. But we've been this way, you know, in like 1968, I taught a class in 1968. There, a lot of stuff happened in 1968, and we were actually really close to like a civil war. I mean, there were riots that we were in this war. I mean, it was really, really bad. The difference today is like you hit the nail on the head. It's the social media. It's the instant like reaction that you get, and it's inescapable. It's not like the 6 o'clock nightly news. Then you turn it off and you have to ponder it and you have to think about it. And then you have to get back to, you know, just like the maintaining the house. It was a lot quieter time, where now your phone's constantly going off with all this fear porn. It's very similar to when, Ted Turner started, CNN. It was CNN, right? Yeah. It was, round the clock news. Is when you only have an hour a day, you have to fill up an hour a day. But when you have 24 hours a day, you got to fill up 24 hours a day. So more things become news. And, you know, in 1962, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. Like, can you imagine what that would have been like? I mean, it was like 13 days of the Soviets bringing these nuclear missile, like, attachments to Cuba. And like, we putting up the blockade is like, what's going to happen if they break that blockade? Then we are in nuclear war. It's the end of the world for 13 days. Okay. So there'd be like a nightly news where they give you the information, then you get the daily newspaper, you get the information, but then you just have to kind of like sit in it. Where now, can you imagine like what it would be like on social media? Just be boom, 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 boom. Yeah. The anxiety and fear that people would have, people go nuts. You know, people went nuts for COVID, just buying up all the toilet paper and all that kind of stuff. People are doing it now. Like, I understand, but I think that's the difference. I don't think we've been, you know, we're more broken or divided than we've ever been. I don't. I think that's kind of always been the case. It comes in waves a little bit, but I think that the difference is the ubiquitousness of information being thrown at us. And it's not just, like Walter Cronkite, you know, trying to like aim for the middle. Everyone listens to either Fox News and it's always Fox News, or MSNBC and it's always MSNBC, or they're listening to, you know, Ben Shapiro and they're just giving one perspective. So they're just getting like, they're the enemy. This is what's happening. And they're stuck in these echo chambers where the scroll that you have on your social media is just going to tell you more of what you love to hear. That's how social media started. It's like, I love model airplanes. So you'd like a couple of model airplane things and your whole feed is just model airplanes. It's like, that's cool. But when it's like, I hate Kamala Harris, then your whole thing is how terrible Kamala Harris is. And then when she does something that you support, you don't even see it. You're like, she has done nothing. It's like, well, the person who loves Kamala Harris and gets only Kamala Harris positive news can give you a whole bunch of things. So why don't you reach out to them and ask them?
Friends, I'm interrupting this episode because I have a big announcement today, one I've been waiting to tell you about. The 2025 Old Fashioned on Purpose Planner is here. It is ready for you to order. We wanted to get it out earlier than ever this year, so you have plenty of time to start thinking about 2025. And I can say without a doubt, this is our best planner yet. We took all the features you love from previous years, plus some things you've been asking for, and rolled them all into this edition. So the first thing you'll notice, there are tabs. Hallelujah. We have tabs for all of the months and the sections. That's been a huge sticking point for so many of you. We finally got it done. The cover is durable PVC. The paper is luxurious, if I do say so myself. It's thick and silky, and it's not going to bleed. We have monthly spreads. We have weekly spreads. We have spots for your menus, your garden, your kitchen, your animal records, what you're reading, your goals for the year, your project mapping, It's all in here and lots more. This is almost 300 pages of organizational goodness, and it will help keep your old-fashioned life on track, regardless of whether you live on 100 acres or you're homesteading in your backyard. So we have a set number of these that we have printed. We will sell out this year, so don't wait too long. Head on over to prairieplanner.com to get a full look at the inside and all the features and to get your copy. Also, we have a special limited run of some custom planner stickers that you can add onto your order. We're selling out of these as we speak. So if you want the stickers, definitely grab your planner sooner versus later. Prairieplanner.com. I cannot wait for you to try it. And definitely post some pictures and tag me over on social once you start putting all of your old-fashioned goodness inside. Yeah.
You know?
People are still underestimating the power of the algorithm. You know, you hear so much. Yeah. They're like, well, you know, everyone's saying this. Everyone's thinking this. I'm like, no, it's just that's what you're being fed on the algorithm. Yeah. Like, it's not. Yeah. And unless you can actively combat that, it just sucks you in and it starts to skew everything.
For sure. Yeah. And, yeah. And it's hard. You have to. It's kind of like it's very strange. Like I've taught a lot of kids over the years, and kids who have been abused. The likelihood that they're going to abuse their own kids is very, very high. Okay. It's like strange yeah. because you go, well, but you know how it feels. So why would you do that? It's like, well, that's all I know. So you have to actively, or if you're a child of like alcoholics, you can't take alcohol in a blasé way. Like you have to be very aware that this is a proclivity of yours and you need to fight it. So the same thing goes for your algorithm. You need to recognize that you're in an echo chamber, that there are a lot of perspectives to this, and then actively seek it out. So you support, let's say you're a conservative and you want to follow Ben Shapiro, then follow someone on the left who you respect,
yes.
You know, a David Pakman or something like that. And then you'll at least get it. Like that's the cool thing about my social media is it's all over the place. It's like AOC and it's JD Vance. And it's like, it's all over the place. You can kind of like see it all. And even if I land on one side of the issue, which I typically do, I can understand why people would disagree based on their background or based on the way that their biology works or anything like that. You have to be intentional. But it's uncomfortable because it's nice to be told that you're right.
Yes, it is uncomfortable. It is. It feels good. And it feels good to be, you know, around people who are like, yeah, yeah, we're, you know, we're on the right side of history. We're doing it. It's, that feels good. It's just appealing to that side of our human nature.
Do you want to do something, Bill?
Oh, sorry. What you said about, yeah. Yeah, go ahead. I want to hear this.
Oh, just real quick. So like, I say this in my class. I go, like, I'll ask you, Joe, how does it feel to be wrong? Like emotionally, what like words come to mind if it's like you're wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't feel good.
Uncomfortable. You know, you might feel dumb. It's whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, no. That's when you find out that you're wrong. Until you find out that you're wrong, it feels like being right. So you feel good, and then when you are when you're revealed to be wrong, then you have all those negative feelings. So you want to avoid those negative feelings. Yeah. You just don't look in the box, as I said. You just don't try to, because it's so disruptive. Why would you seek out to feel dumb or wrong or uncomfortable? That's not in our nature to try to be, to voluntarily seek discomfort. So I'm going to avoid it. And that's what's happening is you have to be intentional to do like, just like getting in an ice bath or going to the gym or whatever. It's like, it's uncomfortable, but it's good for me. You have to treat your brain the same way.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Not looking in the box. Cause we see that all the time. And I've done that. Like, I'm not just passing judgment on other people, but we all do it. Like, I don't want to, I'm not going to look there. Yeah. What I don't know, it's not going to hurt me, but that's such a great way to think of it. Being wrong feels good. And it's just the finding out that you're wrong.
Uh-huh.
That's not good. Okay. I like that. Yeah, yeah. What does history tell us about previous times in civilization where we have gotten to the point of polarization? What happens next, or how do we come back from that, if at all?
Well, unfortunately, I thought this was going to be COVID, because when I was on social media and doing my podcast for about 2 years, a little over 2 years, when COVID hit, or a little less than 2 years, and I was talking about this polarization and how dangerous it was. And then COVID hit, and I was like, all right, this could be the opportunity. What tends to unite us is a common enemy, is a common, like I said, talk about shared values, but like a common mission. I was talking to a friend of mine who's in North Carolina right now, and it's really devastating what happened with the hurricane. Yes. But what he said was, he's like, "What do you know what people aren't talking about? The election. They're not talking about politics. Mm. They're not talking about wokeness. They're not talking about, you know, abortion rights or anything like that. They're just working to dig people out of their homes. Yeah. They're working side by side. I think that what you need to do is have that like common mission. You're shoulder to shoulder moving forward for a common good. That's what gets us out of it. And it wasn't COVID. I thought COVID maybe would be it. Like, we have a common enemy here, and it's not a politicized thing. It's like, it's this disease that we can all unite and try and fight this disease together. But that lasted like 2 days, and then right away it got politicized. Right away, you know, I think that Donald Trump's about obviously a very polarizing figure, and just having him in the White House, just people just, he's like anti-gravity. So anything he says, if he says up, it's got to be down. And so right away it became, you know, like polarized, and it became a political issue, which is really a shame. But to answer your question, unfortunately, it seems like there has to be a common mission to get people on board, you know, like, if someone's racist and then aliens land, okay, and start attacking us, and someone's like, you know what, I'm not going to fight the aliens along next to this black guy. It's like, wow, that's commitment to your racism. I don't think that really happens much. You know, you're going to find out that you have a lot more in common than you do that separates you. You know, right now in North Carolina, it's like we have this thing where we want to, you know, save people from our community or save fellow Americans. And I think it's finding those shared values is the way. But unfortunately, like I said, I think it has to be something big to break us out of it.
Yeah, for sure. And I talk about on social media and here all the time, like, you know, well, one thing I say that gets people really angry at me is I say, you know, I know you're wound up about the election or whatever's on the news. Just like, put down your phone and go outside, put your hands in the dirt, go do something in your community, like work side by side with someone that you know or an acquaintance. And people get really upset. It's almost like, you know, they don't want to look in the box. They want to hold on to the phone. They're addicted to the algorithm. But hopefully, I don't know. I think if my goal is just to get people to break that addiction to the phone, even just for a couple hours, because like when you do go out, and hopefully it's not something as horrific as a hurricane or that sort of devastation that we that forces us into it, but we can choose that before the big giant scary events come. And just those simple acts of shared missions, things like that, it works. It's just people are so resistant, I feel like, to that, unless they're forced into it, which is unfortunate. I'm still trying to figure out how to help them see that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think social media gives you this sense. It's almost like armchair activism. It gives you this sense, because you get the dopamine hit, that you're making positive change. You know, I own this lib on Instagram. Yeah. So now people are going to understand that my side's the right side. Or, you know, I went after this racist Trump supporter, and therefore, you know, I did my part. You get this dopamine hit, and people say like, yeah, great comment. You know, who are in like your echo chamber. It's like, yeah, you have this feeling of doing good in the world, but there isn't really, you know, like a metric to show that you're actually changing people's minds. Typically, embarrassing someone doesn't change their mind. That's not what brings them out of their wrong-headed ways. You know, that's not the way it works. You know, I had Daryl Davis on my podcast twice. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Really interesting guy who broke people out of he's a black guy who broke people out of the KKK by befriending them. You know, he befriended them and then through his actual friendship, you know, like helping him talk. And then they realize like, oh, well, why would I hate someone like Daryl? Because he's actually my friend. You know, Abraham Lincoln had that great quote where it's like, if I make my enemy my friend, doesn't that defeat my enemy? You know, and that's not what you see on social media. It's not people trying to turn their enemies into their friends. It's trying to embarrass their enemies. And that does not change their ways. That just makes them more militant and more entrenched and more angry. And so, but we're still chasing this dopamine hit of getting some sort of win because we get a bunch of likes on the comment we made. Yep. But are you actually making things better, or are you making things worse? Are you driving a wedge between citizens more and more and more, where we've always disagreed in America, but we saw the value in compromise, and we saw the value in understanding, and we recognize that these are our neighbors that we need to work with. And you're not going to get everything you want in a compromise, but you're not going to lose everything either. So you, again, look for that common ground. And that's what I focus on a lot in my work, is like, where can we agree? We can disagree on 99 things. So let's focus on the one thing where we do agree, on the trunk of the tree, and then we can disagree on things down the road a little bit on the branches. But like right now, let's first establish, before it's like I'm pro-life and you're pro-choice, you're a baby killer and you want to, you know, keep put women back in the 1950s. Let's just agree with certain things. Let's agree with certain things, and then we start with there, and then we can move forward. And that's something that I'm always promoting, is like, where can you agree with this person? And aim for that. And I stand by, you know, the interactions. I have a lot of, you know, contentious interactions on social media, but I stand by everything that I'm doing of trying to live up to these principles that that I promote to my students and I promote to people that follow my account. And I think that I have to kind of model that, because I can't go out there and then they said, like, look, you know, Mr. Roosh, look at the way you talk to this person, and yet you're telling me to go out and do things differently. I want to stand by. So the internet has a good memory. Everything I put out there, I try to stand by. And if I did act in a wrongheaded way, then I can be like, yeah, that I can take full ownership. That was wrong. I'm going to learn from it moving on. And I think that's a great way to learn, is to be kind of embarrassed about certain things you have and have some regret, have enough regret to learn from it. And then you let the regret go. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Back to that intellectual humility, which is, I love that term. And I've watched you do that so well on social media, especially because it's hard. It's hard as a content creator. I know every time I put something out that I know will be controversial, and I generally don't go quite to the degree that you do, just because my platform isn't quite there. But even just little controversial things, it's sometimes mentally and physically exhausting just to try to keep those conversations in that common ground realm. What do you have, just tips or strategies on how you do that, how you maintain your own sanity, how you work with the people in your comments that are just not wanting to, they're just very committed to that polarization? How do you handle that and not just be exhausted from that?
Yeah, I actually don't get exhausted from it. I get really energized from it, which is maybe weird of me, but I love Socrates. I love the Socratic method. I love just asking questions. And I think that if I do it in a public way, the wrong ideas will be revealed just through the ignorance of the people that have certain positions. But I also am asking questions not just to do that. I'm asking questions because I'm trying to understand how you could support these ideas that I have thought about a lot and I've researched a lot, and I just like don't understand. Like, I really don't understand how you can support this. So genuine curiosity is really what it goes back to. You know, I have these like three pillars that I have developed over the years on social media of how to navigate it. And it's intellectual humility, genuine curiosity. Like, you are curious. As I said, don't ask rhetorical questions. Get curious. Don't let, you know, the curiosity get purged from you through the traditional school system or something like that. But the third pillar is grace. And grace is a beautiful concept. I love the word. I love what it stands for. The definition I have is like extending courteous goodwill, or like treating someone well even when they don't deserve it. So if someone is very angry, and I've dealt with people who are very, very angry at me, at the world, at certain political stances and stuff like that, is I don't see them as someone who has it all together and is doing well. I see them as someone who's not. You know, having kids is so cool, because I have a 3, a 7, and now he just turned 10. Ah, they're getting old. But when I have like the little ones, you know, when he's like 2, you know, now he's 3 and he's starting to make bad decisions. But when he's 2, he's sinless, essentially, for like, you know, lack of a better term. Yeah. Like he's sinless. He's just there, just living life, trying to survive. He's not making conscious decisions of like, I know right or wrong and I'm choosing wrong. And you start to see, when you have kids, and I'm around teenagers a lot, you start to see that, like, the guy at the Starbucks who walks up to the barista and is like angry, like, I said 2 stevias, not 3, and you put 3 in there. You just see them as like, oh, they're throwing a tantrum. There's stuff going on for them. Like, they're not just the guy who cuts you off in traffic is like angrily throwing up the middle fingers and stuff. I just have like a soft spot in my heart. Maybe it's because I'm a teacher and like we're a soft-hearted lot, but like I go, oh, this guy's really dealing with something that's tough. There's a reason why he's throwing a tantrum. There's some sort of emotional thing going on. And I just get softer. It's like, oh man. And I don't do it in a patronizing way, but like actually, like internally, like I genuinely feel bad for someone who has that kind of reaction to, especially things in politics that might not even affect you. You know, so I try to extend grace to those people, because everyone's dealing with something. You don't know what people are dealing with. You know, so extend absolutely. Some grace, and I think it gets you further.
I agree. And it's easy to not think of the person on the other side of the screen as fully human, because we can't see their eyes and we can't feel their energy. And yeah, it's easy just to see them as some sort of avatar.
So yeah. Oh, Jill, that's happened so advice. Many times.
Yeah.
Like where someone yep. will say something really mean. And then what I'll do is I'll say like, you should not be around kids. You're terrible. All this stuff. So what I do is I get my phone and I'm like with one of my boys or something. And I'll just be like, hi, I'm Will. I'm a real person. You know, this is Gray, my son. Say hi, Gray. Hi. All right. Yes. So I did not mean to offend you. You know, we're here on an educational, you know, learning journey. I'm testing ideas. I'm trying to spark thought. That's all I can do. Socrates said, you know, he can't teach anybody anything. He can only, you know, get people to think. So
yes.
I do that. And then they come back like, oh, sorry, I didn't know you'd see that, or I didn't know you'd react. Like, that's happened so many times where people are like, oh, I didn't expect you to actually react to me. You know, part of that might be, and I have a, you know, it's not like a huge social media account. I'm sure it's way bigger for like, you know, Kylie Jenner or The Rock. But like, I think people just want to get noticed. I think they just want to like, you know, just like get, you know, it'd be nice to get noticed by, you know, Joe Rogan, you know, or something yes. like that. It's like, oh, he knows who I am. He saw me, you know, and it's easy to do that through a negative comment. You know, I tell my students all the time when we talk about something serious, like school shooting. You know, the way I explain it to them is this is a very serious topic, but I think at the core of it, here's what I think it is, Joe. I'm curious your thoughts on this is, I think it's the pattern that I'm seeing is it's a lot of young men, but it's people who are very nihilistic about the world. The world yeah. is just a dark place and I don't know my place in it. I have no purpose. I have no mission. Why am I here? If I didn't get up out of bed in the morning, would people's lives be negatively affected? People might be sad if I disappeared, because like I have family and friends to some degree, but like yeah. maybe I don't have a lot of friends. Maybe right. I don't have an attentive family. And then if I just disappeared, nothing would happen. Well, that makes you have no purpose. We just moved recently and we're getting things together and I grab some like weird tchotchke or something. Like I get like this thing and I'm like, what is it? Okay. So like I have a remote control. Okay. I know what that does. I have a pen. I know what that does. What is this thing? It's like, if you don't know what its purpose is, it's gone. Like I don't need that thing anymore. And that goes for right. people too. If you don't know what your purpose is, you don't have meaning in your life, then you just go, all right, well then I could just be discarded. So yes. they become suicidal. But the problem with suicidal thoughts, a lot of them, but one of them is if it doesn't matter if while I'm living, then when I die, it won't matter either. And I want right. to have an impact on the world, you know, and it's a lot easier to have a negative impact on the world than a positive one. Okay. And I tell my students, this gets kind of dark, but like this was influenced by Nicholas Cruz, who shot at Parkland School, and he made a manifesto okay. video. He said, my name is Nicholas Cruz. You don't know who I am, but you will. And it's if you want to have a positive impact on thousands of people and be known around the world, like actually matter in the world for a positive reason, it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard to build a company or something like that. But if you want to have a negative impact, and I tell my students, I was like, it's, you know, whatever, it's 9:30 by 10 o'clock, you can be remembered for generations.
Yeah.
You just have to go out and do something really, really horrific and people will yeah. talk about you. And I think that's at the core of a lot of what's happening with these school shooters is like, I just want to matter in the world. If I shoot at Trump or I shoot up a school, you know, generations will feel that and they'll know who I am. It's like these kids that I've seen over the years who are ignored by their family. So they get in trouble because if mom and dad show up at the principal's office and they yell at me on the way home, at least they're not ignoring me. You know, Elie Wiesel, the great author from the Holocaust said the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. So yes. if you feel indifferent about your position in this world, it's like being hated by the world is at least better than being just ignored and forgotten by the world. And I think that that's an issue as well.
I love that you put that together. I've been fascinated by the crisis of meaning, and I've been digging into that for a while because I feel like, well, there's so many pieces of that in our modern society. I think a huge part of it is, you know, you've been on Kate Kavanaugh's podcast, right? You know, you're familiar
yes.
with her. Oh, I love her. I adore awesome. Her.
Me too. She's awesome.
Yes. We both are complete industrial revolution nerds and we laugh about it. But like, I feel like industrialization, it's not all evil. There's a lot of nuance there. There's good and bad. But a lot of that took away a lot of our meaning that was intrinsic to us as humans yeah. since the beginning of time. And so I've been so interested in just the crisis of meaning in modernity, even though we have all our needs met, why are we so, so there's so much flailing and there's so much depression and there's so much just lack of purpose. And especially in the young men, I think they've been cast aside for a while now. And you see that, see it so much for multiple reasons, but I hadn't put together the negative, comments or the negative actions as a way to get the attention and the meaning that they're so desperately craving. But I think that's dead on. It makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's like the easier, it's the easier pathway to get.
It is.
To feel like you matter. You know, I say something terrible to, you know, a big celebrity, to Dwayne Johnson. He's just like, oh, Will, you know, that's not very cool. And now I think they're blah, blah, blah. It's like, see who I am. You know, how do I get on Dwayne Johnson's radar by doing something positive? Like,
it can take a lot of work.
It's really hard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, all the pieces of social media and its instant dopamine and all that just feeds that fire like crazy. Yeah. Oh, that's something to chew on. I'm going to be ruminating on that one for a while. So kind of on that, kind of in that same realm, but if we kind of take it back to parenting or influencing young people, one thing I hear a lot of people say, and I've said it, as parents or educators, we want to teach kids how to think, not what to think. I think that's a wonderful phrase. I love what it stands for. But what I often see, and I've probably done it myself, is that we say that, but we don't actually always put that into practice. And I see a lot of just like stamping or, you know, attempting to stamp beliefs on the kids instead. So how can we actually put that into action as a parent? What does that look like?
I think that you have to model it. I think that there's a lot of great tactics that you can do to make this the norm. I think showing kids like in your household, you know, examples of places you've changed your minds. I gave you an example with like the payday loans. You know, hey guys, you know, around the dinner table, you know, we do family dinners every night. You know, it's kind of a non-negotiable. So we sit around, we talk about our days, and we talk about different things. Talking to your kids about the ways you've changed your mind. You know, talking about you know, these revelations you've had about how you're evolving your thinking, just making that norm, asking them a lot of questions, getting them to challenge the things that they believe to be right and wrong, you know, and that even goes for like your fundamental beliefs. And I do think that, you know, if you have people in your audience who are, you know, Christian or religious, I think that I think it goes there. I mean, that's a very important thing for me, but it's not unchallengeable. Like you're supposed to ask questions so you can get to it. And if you do, but if you believe that that is like deeper truth, that you believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, the life, then don't be scared of asking questions. Like, you know, that's a way to really like showcase your faith. I think is to just be like, it can withstand the stress tests. So I think that's a big one. When teachers always say, you know, teach kids, how, not what to think. Again, it comes down to yes, but that means everywhere. Okay. And that includes places where you might be very, very emotional. You know, one of the cool things I've gotten from doing my podcast is I've talked to so many diverse people. I've had like 9 different transgender people on the podcast, you know, MAGA hat wearers who were there on January 6th and then blue haired activists. Like what it really comes down to, I think a big part of it is identity, is how you identify really matters. So like, I'm like white and I'm tall. So if someone says like, you know, you're not that tall, like that doesn't really affect me because my identity isn't connected with my height. Someone says something against white people, it's like, it doesn't really matter. But I'm an educator. I believe in viewpoint diversity. I'm a father and I'm a husband. Those are like really where my identity is like really strong. So if you challenge those things, when the people say like, you're actually not, you know, open-minded, or you're actually, you know, not a good teacher, you're not a good husband or father, that's the stuff where I get like emotional and I get defensive, because that's where my identity aligns. I've had transgender people on, when I say like, how do you identify? They say like, as a cat person or a computer programmer. So they're less triggered by like a lot of the culture war stuff around gender, because it's just not where they see themselves. They don't see themselves as their genitalia. They see themselves in another realm. So I think that one of the ways to recognize this, of getting kids, you know, how to think and not what to think, is to be aware of your identity and then the people that you're interacting with's identity. Okay. So, you know, helping people to helping to see people the way they wish to be seen will help lower their walls, but also be aware of where your triggers are at, because we all have it. You know, if you, you know, are really focused on being sincere and someone calls you a fraud, you're going to react to that, you know, in a like emotionally charged way. And emotions, as beautiful as they are, you know, they make an excellent slave, but a terrible master, and they are going to cloud you. You know, emotions are going to blind us to objective truth. And I think that it's really important to get, you know, a grasp of those emotional triggers, know what they are, and then get a grasp of them. And this goes for young people too, because so much in the political world is just emotional triggers. They're arguing from an emotional standpoint, not a logical standpoint. And you have to be careful when you're going for truth. You know, there is a logical need to make sense that of what you're saying, you know?
Yeah. I love that identity note, because that's so true. And I hadn't thought of it like that, but yeah. Cause I mean, I deal with a lot of online criticism for sure. And there's some that I'm like, whatever, say what you want. And then there's others that I'm like typing and then I'm a backspacing and and it's always tied to identity or those tender spots where you're like, no, I have to prove you're wrong. So that's a great way to think about it, especially when dealing with others who are different. I love that.
Yeah.
I also know just it's so challenging as a parent to model. I mean, it isn't, I guess I was raised with such a black and white viewpoint. There was a security in that of always knowing exactly where the boundaries are and having that imparted upon me, even though it was to my detriment later on, but it was comfortable at the time and it felt easy. And now when my own kids ask me those same questions and I'm like, well, like, here's how I change my mind. I don't know. Let's talk about both sides. Here's what some people think. Here's what other people think. It's so much more messy, but good. It's good. And it feels like I know it's the right path, but it's just, it takes more effort. So I understand why it's so much easier just to imprint on the kids. Cause that's it's just simple. Yeah.
That's what ideologies do. You know, they give you a map.
Yeah.
You know, but
a map.
But
like we want the formula. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me the formula. Yeah.
But like any map, the map is not the real thing. It's pixelated. It's going to leave like gaps. It's not like the world is far too complex to understand through an ideology. It gets you there. It's like a heuristic. It gets you to a point where you have an answer for right and wrong, but it's not going to leave in. That's why I love nuance. And that's why I talk about nuance with the most controversial topics of, you know, abortion and guns and immigration is, you know, race issues is like, I'm just fascinated by like all sides, because I think it's important to recognize that there's a reason all these contentious issues, the country is split roughly 50-50. So it can't just be that people on that side, that half the population are just bad people. It can't be like, that's too simplistic. That's not the way it works. So lean into like, all right, so what is it? You know, like what am I missing here? There's got to be stuff that you're missing. And again, I think that's a really fun journey to go on. I think that instilling that in your kids early, you know, I do it my students, and sometimes it's really disruptive. You know, I've taught at schools that, you know, we're like, I taught a religious school, and that school, as I said, and like that school had like a clear ideology, but I would question it all the time. I'd like, you know, how do you know? Like, you have all these answers and things, but how do you? And I actually didn't get in trouble. That's what was so cool about that school is like they were down for it. Cause I think that if you have a lot of strong, real faith in your religion that you believe it holds up, then you can challenge it all. You can stress test it all you want. I made this wall, made this building, and it's strong. So you can push on the walls all you want, cause it's going to stand the test of time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So if someone has a child in the school system, and I have a foot in both worlds now. We've homeschooled. I homeschool one child, and I have two children in a charter school we started. So I live in all the worlds. But I have audience in both worlds as well. If someone has a child in the school system, public, private, whatever, how can they support the critical thinking at home? I mean, we talked about the modeling. We talked about being open. I know there's a lot of fear right now, potentially justified, of the school system. And I think there's a lot of broken pieces and there's a lot of worries about those ideologies being really forced upon the kids. So if you have your kid in that sort of system, it's the best thing you have right now. How can you help foster that critical thinking at home?
At home, if they're in a traditional system?
If they're in a traditional system, and that's kind of where you're at right now.
Yeah. So I think just going through the regular practice of asking them, you know, what could the other side be dealing with. One of the activities I do in my class is I have the students, like on one of the first days, is I have them share a very positive memory that they have that involved other people. So it's like, I hit the winning hockey goal. Cool. Okay. Now tell me the whole story, write it down. Then tell me the exact same story from the perspective of the goalie on the other team.
Oh,
they write the whole story. Now tell it from a third perspective, maybe that goalie's mom, you know? And then so what that does is it gets them to understand that the world, their worldview is not the worldview. And there's a whole bunch of different things that you can do like that to get them to just recognize that the way they see the world is not the way that everyone else sees the world. And a win for them might be a loss for someone else. You know, a policy, you know, every law is going to, help someone and hurt someone. So who is it helping and then who is it hurting? And you just do this through a whole, you know, regular process of what could you be missing? How did what you say or how did this win for you affect other people negatively? It doesn't take away from, you know, like, oh, that was a great memory. Still was a great memory. It's just more robust now because when you lose, someone else is winning. And that could be a positive thing. So I just think like getting closer and closer to the truth, it might make you a little more uncomfortable if you just say like, well, the goalie on the other side was a bad person, you know, like, no, they're trying to play like you, you know? And I think that they're like that kind of stuff is think about who else would be negatively affected and what are you missing, you know, and just making that a regular practice. Yeah.
I love that. I think a lot of adults, we could do that too. We could do that exercise too. Just do some journaling. Absolutely. And that's brilliant.
Yeah, I love it.
Just simple empathy building. Yeah, that's awesome. I love it. I'm going to use that one for sure.
It is.
One more question just about just education. A little bit off topic, but I've been really chewing on this a lot, just both with the kids that we deal with at the charter school. And also I employ a lot of young adults in another business of ours. And this one is what keeps me up at night. In your experience as an educator and working with lots of kids and lots of backgrounds, how can we help the kids in our lives build resilience? Do you have any thoughts on that? I know it's a little off topic, but I'm just really chewing on that right now. I'm just curious to hear what you might have to say.
Yeah, I'm working with this with my own kids right now, my boys, is you have to meet them where they're at and you do baby steps. You know, like a marathon is one foot in front of the other. So it's small incremental things. So, you know, it could be getting them, you know, they don't want to do their homework or they don't want to, you know, eat a bad food. Is you just, you know, just start very small, you know, and then you just, you know, give them like one little piece of broccoli if they don't like broccoli. Okay. So it's just like, all right, one little piece. And you just build it up slow, and you give them a lot of positive reinforcement. Great job for doing that. Okay. But it's definitely tricky. I think that you have to just be able to just help them see the benefits of just little wins. You don't have to conquer everything. You don't have to be everything. It's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay. And let's get comfortable with the uncomfortable by making it the norm. You know, our family motto, every day I drop them off from school, it's with family motto, I can do hard things. So part of their identity is I can do hard things. I do hard things, you know, supporting them. I think doing it with them, you know, like we do like ice baths in our house and I'm always like the first one to go. And it's like, I'm not going to ask you guys to do anything I'm not willing to do myself. I think throughout the years, my students have seen me, you know, take on challenges. I do like 7-day water fasts and stuff like that. And I think when they see that, they're like, okay, he can do it, then I can do it too. You know, the willingness of the parent to go through that process along with their child, I think is really, really important. You know, the building grit is crucial. And that's what's lacking a lot in like Generation Z or Generation, what's the next one? Alpha is just that grit. Yeah. So starting small, just get a little uncomfortable every single day and then recognize the benefits of getting a little bit more uncomfortable, I think is a big part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm also seeing, those Z alpha, whatever those are. Yeah. I haven't sorted those out yet. There is that. It is missing. The grit is missing. And I think potentially, I said it was off topic, but maybe it ties it all back kind of to the beginning of when it's uncomfortable to be around people who are different. It's uncomfortable to look into the box of questioning our beliefs and our paradigms. And so maybe that part of that grit building is that's going to all come together and work itself out if we can help foster that in our young people and the kids in our lives. So that's great advice. I think we can do hard things. Yeah.
Just making it the norm. Just making it the norm.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Being uncomfortable won't kill you most of the time. Maybe every once in a while, but not
we're actually anti-fragile.
Not in everyday life.
No, we're anti-fragile. We are
anti-fragile. Yes.
So
we are anti-fragile. Yeah, absolutely.
What doesn't kill you actually does make you stronger.
Absolutely. I love that book.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to land the plane because I know you have a lot of things that you're working on in your life. But before we go, can you just give us the lowdown about PatterDocs? Because I know that there are a lot of people in my audience who are going to want to check that out.
Yeah, please do. So I'm actually, right after this, I'm going to jump on a live class for my civics class. So I've been very successful in the classroom to do these things, to bring up, viewpoint diversity, critical thinking, big pattern recognition. It's called PatterDocs because it's the idea of once you recognize patterns, then you can make sense of the world. So it's not just like studying like the names of the generals and who flanked who in the Battle of Saratoga. That's not stuff you remember. Okay. It's conflict, right? Understanding conflict. Okay. You're fighting over scarce resources. You're fighting over different ideologies. The same reason why you fight with your brother or sister, or the same reason why we fight global wars. Okay. So you look for these patterns. And if you understand pattern recognition, so many times when there's like a crisis going on, whether it's an election or COVID or the George Floyd stuff, people would come to me and my account would blow up because like, help me make sense of this. And I could just look through history and go, oh, well, we've seen this before. So it's pattern recognition. It's very like broad strokes. It's not memorization of dates and facts. It's understanding why things happen. So right now it's a US history course. It's a civics course. There's recorded high quality, great quality courses that I've shown to my former students like, oh, you've really captured what we did, you know, because I've been hearing for decades about how my class and my approach is just different from everyone else. So the recorded classes, but then we meet live and it's just like Socratic seminars, like ask me questions. I'm going to ask you questions. And I also want to just take what I did in the classroom successfully and get it out to as many people as possible. You know, I think scale matters, you know, and aren't we glad that Jordan Peterson is not just a therapist for one person at a time? Yep. Aren't we glad that Peter Attia or Andrew Huberman left their labs and are out there sharing with everybody? And I think that I felt like it was an obligation of mine because I knew what I was doing was really positive. I've done it with so many different kinds of kids to get it out to people that, you know, wouldn't normally have access to me essentially. So yeah, I would love for anyone who has teenagers to come check it out. We have, you know, there's all kinds of scholarships available and whatever. I want to teach as many students as possible. Okay. And I always have. They've always been like, my administration be like, you already have a full class. Do you want two more? It's like, Yeah, I want to teach as many as possible. So that's what PatterDocs is doing. And it's going to continue to grow. And it's diverse kids. I have kids enrolled from South Dakota and Ohio and Arizona and Minnesota. So you get, you know, a whole bunch of diversity. And then it's a place to just bring back curiosity. Like, this is the place where you can ask as many questions as you want. You will never get in trouble for being curious at PatterDocs. And I think that that's something that is desperately needed. So I kind of looked left, looked right. No one was doing this. So like, all right, I guess I got to build a business.
It's you now. There you go. And it is desperately needed. And I was so glad when you launched it, because before you launched it, I would watch what you do. And I'm like, man, those kids in his class are so freaking lucky. I wish more kids could have that. And here you are. So this is awesome. I love it.
Thank you.
PatterDocs.com, right? And we're going to put all the links in the show notes, guys, but PatterDocs.com, is that the best place? And then you also have your own personal website, but is it so williamroosh.com? But
yeah, that's
which one
that's,
should they go to
that
first?
Has some like freebies on it and things like that. There's all, you know, debate to dialogue, like there's a bunch of freebies, but PatterDocs is the online education platform. You can email me there.
Awesome.
Even if you're just not sure, you just want to learn more. I love hearing from these families and parents who are lost. Like, my kid's not motivated. I can teach a lot of stuff. You know, I could teach rush into a chimp. I just need the kind of opportunity to do it and get to know these kids.
Yes. Yes. Awesome. Okay. We're going to drop both those in the show notes, guys. Well, thank you so much. This was so fun. It was so enlightening. I just love how you think about the world. So thank you for sharing that with us today.
Oh, thank you, Jill. Thank you guys for tuning in. Appreciate you.